Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. President Obama will be among the world leaders who will speak at the funeral later today for former Israeli President Shimon Peres. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with former U.S. President Bill Clinton ahead of the funeral. Earlier in the day, Clinton joined thousands of mourners paying respects outside of Israel's parliament building in Jerusalem, where Peres' casket lay in state. It's expected to be the largest such gathering in Israel since the 1995 funeral of assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. The United States warned Thursday that is on the brink of ending talks with Russia over the assault on Aleppo, where the United Nations says a humanitarian catastrophe is unfolding, unlike any witnessed so far in Syria's brutal five-year war. With no let-up in the military campaign, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry admitted that months of diplomacy to end the war had hit a dead end.
We've made it crystal clear to them that under those kinds of circumstances, it is not possible to be cooperating, and we need to see a change.
Airstrikes pounded Aleppo province while at least 11 civilians, including seven children, died during attacks, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Russia and the U.S. have traded blame for last week's collapse of a ceasefire deal. The U.S. economy expanded at a slightly faster pace in the spring than previously reported. That was aided by newfound strength in business construction. The Commerce Department said Thursday the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of the economy, expanded at an annual pace of 1.4% in the April-June quarter. On Wall Street, stocks dropped to 195. This is VOA. Amnesty International says Sudanese government forces have used chemical weapons against civilians in the Darfur region. The human rights group said in a report Thursday that the attacks may have killed as many as 250 civilians and injured hundreds more. Sudan's Minister of Justice has rejected the report, saying in a letter that Sudan was astonished to hear this accusation and calling Amnesty's evidence unreliable. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Each and every one of you have the chance to make sure that we keep our country on the right path. We have 40 days to win an election that's going to affect the next 40 years of our country.
And that was Hillary Rodham Clinton out on the campaign trail. We're sorry we don't have that audio for you right now. On the campaign trail against Donald Trump, who was also out campaigning on Thursday.
Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders had very few people at their rally yesterday. And that's because they don't like Hillary, and Bernie sold out to the devil.
Well, a New Jersey transit machinist at the Hoboken train station in New Jersey when a train crashed says he saw it coming in at a high rate of speed and strike a bumper block, which caused the front car to go into the air. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says the engineer involved in the train in Hoboken is in critical condition.
This train came in at a high rate of speed into the station and crashed through all of the barriers, bringing it right to the interior wall of the Hoboken terminal.
Christie says one woman was killed in the crash and 108 people were injured. Authorities had previously said one person was killed and more than 100 were injured. Again, Amnesty International, as we said, says Sudanese government forces have used chemical weapons against civilians in the Darfur region. Sudan's Minister of Justice has rejected the report, saying in a letter that Sudan was astonished to hear the accusation and calls Amnesty's evidence unreliable. Here's VOA's Jill Craig in Nairobi.
I was actually at the opposite end of the terminal when I heard the noise. When I exited the office, folks were running away from the train, screaming and things like that. And that's when I said, oh my God. And I went towards it just because there were folks sort of in shock and injured and things like that. We just wanted to help them get out of the way.
I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gabon's opposition leader calls for sanctions against the government as the ICC begins an initial inquiry into deadly election violence.
Opposition leader and former minister Jean Ping is asking the Gabonese people to reject the authority of President Ali Bongo, calling him an imposter with blood of the Gabonese on his hands.
That's VOA's Emily Yop in Abidjan. 23 security officials have been arrested in Burundi for trying to assassinate a top government official. Sudan rejects an Amnesty International report suggesting its forces use chemical weapons in Darfur. And Zambian President Edgar Lungu appoints a record 8 women to his new cabinet.
I think most of the women that have been appointed, they are qualified for the job in terms of educational qualification, in terms of experience. They have that qualification.
Julia Chibuta is the executive director of the advocacy group Zambia National Women's Lobby. 2 new reports say most South Sudanese do not get justice for violent crimes committed against them. And global health was a top concern at the just concluded UN General Assembly. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gabon's opposition leader, Jean Ping, has called on the Gabonese people to reject what he called the electoral coup d'etat of newly re-elected President Ali Bongo. Bongo was sworn in this week for a second term following a hotly disputed election. Emily Yob filed this report from Abidjan with additional reporting in Libreville by VOA's French Tour Service Africa reporter, Jean Rovis.
Opposition leader and former minister Jean Ping is asking the Gabonese people to reject the authority of President Ali Bongo, calling him an imposter with blood of the Gabonese on his hands. Ping continues to insist he won the August 27 presidential poll and accuses Bongo, the son of Omar Bongo, who ruled the oil-producing Central African nation for over 4 decades, of rigging the results. Ping said he does not intend to take part in the political dialogue that Bongo called for shortly after he was declared the winner. I will not associate myself to this vain attempt to legitimize the abuse of authorities that the Gabonese people denounce, Ping said. And I'm calling every Gabonese to an active resistance until it ends. Ping announced a national day of mourning on October 6 for the victims of the post-election violence and a national dialogue under his own terms to, in his words, reconcile the population. Ping, a former ally of Bongo's father who fell out with the current president a couple of years ago, has also called for the international community to step in. Bongo's re-election received a lukewarm acknowledgement from most of the international community, including the European Union, who has expressed doubt about the fairness of the poll. Ping said he's asking for the international community to impose targeting sanctions against the people responsible for this electoral coup. The opposition leader asked Amnesty International and the International Criminal Court, or ICC, to investigate alleged human rights violations and killings committed during the deadly unrest following the disputed elections. Earlier Thursday, the ICC announced it is opening a preliminary probe into the unrest, but at the request of the Gabonese government, which, in turn, accuses Ping's supporters of incitement to genocide and crimes against humanity. The ICC will determine whether there is enough evidence to launch a full investigation. Emily Yarp for VOA News in Abidjan.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu is scheduled to open parliament today, Friday, following his re-election last month. This comes on the heels of the appointment of 8 women to his cabinet, a decision described by one women's group in the country as a positive step forward. In a statement, Lungu said there was a need to encourage more women to become involved in politics. The portfolios for the new cabinet appointees include higher education, agriculture, gender, community development and social welfare, and lands. Juliet Chibuta, executive director of the advocacy group Zambia National Women's Lobby, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the inclusion of the women is an achievement worth mentioning.
Zambia is a signatory to many international instruments on gender, which promote gender equality. So when we saw that the president was making appointments and including women, for us, we thought that it was very progressive, because as a country, we need to adhere to the laws and policies on gender and also to the international instruments that we have ratified. Then apart from that, the fact that we call ourselves as a country as a democracy, we need to ensure that we are included both men and women in the leadership of this nation.
Some people are suggesting that the inclusion of citizens into cabinet should be based on qualification rather than gender, and that the advocacy, your advocacy calling and praising President Lungu for including women in cabinet is misplaced. What do you say to that?
No, I think that is not true, because we have women who are well qualified. I think most of the women that have been appointed, they are qualified for the job in terms of educational qualification, in terms of experience, they have that qualification. But aside from that, why is it that when it comes to the appointment of men, no one asks about the qualifications, no one asks about whether they are competent or not. But when it comes to a woman, people will always ask whether that woman is qualified or whether that woman is able to do the work that they've been appointed for. But I think I would safely say that amongst the women that have been appointed, if you look at the educational qualification, most of them are qualified. Most of them have the experience. I can even cite examples like the Minister of Labour, the woman that has been appointed. She's been in the labour movement for many, many years, and she's held senior positions within the institutions where she has worked. And then amongst the women that have been appointed, we have professors, we have women with the masters. So the issue of women not being qualified and not being appointed on merit is neither here nor there.
Juliet, what do you say to critics who are of the view that the fact that President Lungu has included women in the cabinet does not necessarily mean his government will be successful, and that it is too early to describe the move as progressive in this instance? What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is that some of those women have past records where they have worked, and some of them have been in government before. Some of them have been members of parliament, and we have seen how they've been able to influence policy and decisions in government, meaning that judging from their past experience, they are bringing value to cabinet, they are bringing value to government, and they are able to make the government successful. So that is how we were able to judge them, even as they were being appointed.
You supported a lot of women candidates during the recent August 11 general election. Overall, how did that go? And would you say that it is an achievement or a significant step forward in the promotion of women into governance in Zambia?
I think it's an achievement, and also it's a significant step forward, because right now, if you compare our 2011 results and how many women were elected, and now, in 2011, at the point of election, we had 17 women being elected. But now we have 26 women who were elected, so meaning that at least in parliament, meaning that at least we have managed to move a step forward.
Julia Chibuta is the executive director of the advocacy group Zambia National Women's Lobby. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Burundi has arrested 23 security officials since last week for trying to assassinate a top government official. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Both government and opposition leaders have been targeted for assassination in Burundi since last year, when violence erupted. Among those lost are some of highly ranked generals, and most recently, an armed group shot and killed the East African Legislative Assembly chair and former East African Committee Minister Hafsa Mosi. Police spokesman Pierre Nkurikiye says that the arrested have been plotting another assassination.
So they have been arrested, accused of destabilizing the country. They were planning to kill some high authorities, policemen and 15 soldiers. Now they are in jail in intelligence service.
Declined to reveal the top government official who was alleged to be the target.
Yes, we know, but I can tell it to media now because police investigation is going on. So it means that the police investigation is still going, so I can't give you all details about the spy. But now we know who they were, who mandated them, and who they were targeting.
The Burundi police spokesman declined to reveal the mastermind of the plot as the investigations are ongoing. Last year, protests erupted against President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to pursue a third term, which he won. Opponents say this decision to run more than two terms was unconstitutional. The government says since protests against the president's decision began last year, at least 150 police officers have been prosecuted, 59 have been jailed, and 37 others dismissed. The political crisis has led to the killings of more than 1,000 people and to the flight of thousands from Burundi to neighboring countries. Human rights violations have also continued to increase since then. The UN Independent Investigation on Burundi into violations and abuses of human rights reported the increased systematic killings of opposition leaders. They said that the country is at risk of genocide. The UN team recommended that the UN Security Council consider sanctions and other measures, including arms embargoes, travel bans, the authorization of the use of force by a peacekeeping operation. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 30th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time now, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Amnesty International says Sudanese government forces use chemical weapons against civilians in the Darfur region. The human rights group said in a report on Thursday that the attacks may have killed as many as 250 civilians and injured hundreds more. Sudan's Minister of Justice has rejected the report, saying in a letter that Sudan was astonished to hear this accusation and calling Amnesty's evidence unreliable. From Nairobi, viewer Jill Craig has more.
Since January, people in the Jebel Mara area of Darfur have reported blisters and rashes on their skin, cases of their skin falling off, eye problems including total vision loss, bloody vomit and diarrhea, and severe respiratory problems. All of these are symptoms of chemical exposure that Amnesty International says came from weapons used by the government of Sudan. As many as 250 people, including many children, may have died as a result of chemical attacks, says the rights group. Muthoni Wanyeki is Amnesty International's regional director for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes.
This is the first time, as far as we are aware of, as far as survivors and monitors on the ground, this is the first time that we've documented use of chemical weapons. So it is a sort of radical departure.
The report released by Amnesty on Thursday states that Sudanese security forces have deliberately targeted civilians and their property, including the probable use of blister agents, a banned class of chemical weapons, in roughly 32 villages in the Jebel Mara area. Calls by VOA to two Sudanese government officials for response went unanswered. But the Reuters news agency reports that Sudan's UN ambassador said the Amnesty report was utterly unfounded and that Sudan does not possess any type of chemical weapons. Amnesty International says it conducted 235 phone interviews for the report, since the Sudanese government did not allow them field access. The group says local intermediaries helped to identify and contact survivors. Amnesty International has asked the UN Security Council and state parties to the Convention on Chemical Weapons to conduct follow-up investigations in Darfur. It is calling upon Sudan's government to stop the attacks and to also give international aid agencies access to Jebel Mara.
I think it's really important that this get back on the map. I think we have dropped attention as Africa, as the rest of the world, on Sudan, on Darfur, and the other conflict areas in the Sudan. And I think given the sort of, like I said, the overall push in the context of the European refugee crisis is re-engage with the government of Sudan. And this kind of re-engagement can't happen until this sort of thing stops.
The UN estimates more than 300,000 people have died in Darfur since 2003, when rebels there launched a rebellion citing discrimination and marginalization. The government responded by unleashing militias known as Janjaweed to cause chaos in the region. Fighting has never entirely stopped in the 13 years since. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in Darfur, but has denied the allegations and avoided arrest. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Two new reports released this week by the University for Peace Center in The Hague, the South Sudan Law Society, and the Dutch NGO Pax Christi say most South Sudanese who have suffered from rape, torture, or assault do not receive justice. The reports say only people with financial resources and time have the opportunity to receive justice in a court of law and be compensated. Wake Simon Wudu has more from Nairobi.
The reports are from the research project Intersections of Truth, Justice and Reconciliation in South Sudan and are based on information gathered in November and December 2015, just weeks after the South Sudan government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition signed a peace agreement. The reports document people's experience once violent crimes were committed against them and what happened when they tried to seek justice. Rance Williams is a research fellow at the University for Peace. He co-authored the report and says respondents were interviewed on violent crimes such as cattle raids, murder, armed robbery, abduction, torture, and sexual assault. He says 60% of the respondents said their household experienced one or more cases of violent crime in the past 5 years.
And we find actually that the security and justice services are often very unavailable or considered inaccessible or inadequate. We also found that people with more time and financial resources to invest have actually a higher chance of obtaining justice for a crime.
In the vast majority of cases, respondents said they did not report the crime to anyone and did not engage in self-help options such as negotiation or revenge. Williams says when researchers asked why, the majority answered that they did not know what to do or where to go for support or advice. The chairperson of South Sudan Women's Peace Network says the report highlights the extent to which the culture of impunity is so widespread. Priscilla Joseph Kuch says the judiciary system in South Sudan needs capacity building.
Within those structures of the governance that and the justice structures, the issue of capacity is very, very big. Because when we talk of justice, without recorded statements, there's no justice.
23-year-old Deborah Awut, who resides in Western Lakes State, says impunity in her village is part of the culture. She says one time her brother was mistakenly beaten over marriage issue. Awut says she had given up trying to attain justice for her brother.
My brother was beaten. He was in the hospital, like lying on his bed helplessly, that we were even not expecting that he would survive that that incident by then. From then, no one was even able to bring the culture to the police or even to the court of law.
The organizations also reported that more than 70% of the respondents wanted public dialogue about what led up to the conflict. Some respondents believe reconciliation will allow victims to know what happened to their family members. More than 1,900 respondents were interviewed for the research. It was reported that after the conflict began in December 2013, more than 90% of women reported they were victimized during the fighting. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi, Kenya.
Global health was a top concern when the UN General Assembly convened last week. Among those present was Dr. Thomas Frieden, head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC is the federal agency responsible for safeguarding the nation's health and promoting health globally. In the first of a two-part interview, Dr. Frieden spoke with viewers Adam Phillips about the state of health in Africa.
In different parts of Africa, there are different challenges. In some parts of Africa, the malaria transmission is very intense. Mozambique is an example. West Africa is an example. And the rates of infection with malaria are extraordinarily high, where most people in a community may have the parasite in their blood. And it's causing a high proportion of childhood deaths. Throughout the African continent, tuberculosis remains a major problem, especially where there's a lot of HIV. And tuberculosis is curable. we should be able to find it, treat it, prevent it from spreading. But we're particularly concerned about the spread of antibiotic-resistant infections. This really threatens to undermine modern medicine all around the world.
How does antibiotic resistance actually work?
If you use an antibiotic and you don't take it for the full course, or it doesn't totally kill the bacteria, then the strains of the bacteria that are resistant to that antibiotic become dominant. And now you've got drug-resistant bacteria. In my own field of tuberculosis, we saw that spread rapidly. Patients would develop drug-resistant bacteria, then spread it to others, who would then come down with drug-resistant tuberculosis. Antibiotics are a gift from a previous generation. We have to protect them so that they'll be available for us when we need them and for our children when they need them.
In your view, what's the big picture concerning non-infectious diseases in Africa?
All throughout Africa, we have the increasing burden of heart attack, stroke, cancer. These are problems that families, communities, and countries can ill afford. This is largely a reflection of uncontrolled high blood pressure, tobacco use, and just as many health issues rely on political commitment and a healthcare system that works, we actually can prevent a lot of those heart attacks and strokes and cancers by reducing tobacco use, by reducing sodium in food supply, by improving the treatment of high blood pressure and improving the care of people with diabetes and heart disease and other health problems.
I know that in your career you've been a real activist against tobacco use. How can those ideas be exported to Africa?
Actually, in Africa, there's a much lower level of cigarette use. Until now, the tobacco industry had not really attacked Africa, but they may. And it's very important that African societies retain their resilience to avoid that kind of death marketing, if you will. We know what works to reduce tobacco use. You make the cigarettes expensive. You don't let people smoke them and kill other people by smoking them in public places or workplaces. You run hard-hitting ads against them. You don't let the tobacco industry market or advertise or promote. And for smokers who want to quit, you, to the extent you can, provide support for helping them to quit smoking.
The UN General Assembly has just convened last week in New York, and of course the CDC was an important player, as it always is. I wonder what you've got to say about what you took away and the big picture.
The United Nations has the potential to help countries take health more seriously. Unfortunately, politically, health often doesn't get the attention it should. So having it here prominently at the General Assembly, these are great opportunities not just to motivate the United Nations agencies, such as the World Health Organization and UNICEF, but also member countries, to have a kind of healthy competition. Who's the most prepared? Who's the healthiest? And what are the lessons that we can learn from each other? The United States doesn't have a monopoly on good health practices. In fact, our health system could be a lot better than it is. We can learn from others, but there are also some positive aspects from all around the world that we can all learn from to help people live longer, healthier, more productive lives.
That was Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He spoke with viewers Adam Phillips in New York. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somalia's government is demanding an explanation from the United States for Wednesday's deadly airstrike in central Somalia. The Pentagon said in a news release Thursday that its forces launched a self-defense strike against Al-Shabaab near the town of Galkayo, killing at least 9 militants. And Sudan's justice minister has refuted claims by displaced persons in the Jebel Mara area of Darfur that they suffer chemical exposure at the hands of the government of Sudan. That is it for this Friday, September 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Bedford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar has called for an armed struggle against the government of President Salva Kiir. a move that could mark a renewal of the country's civil war. We'll discuss the new developments in South Sudan next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.